So today we dive back into our series on Daniel, which I think was over a month ago when we had to take a little hiatus for the Christmas season. So we're back. And we left Daniel in the lion's den. In the lion's den. So, I mean, how terrible. I mean, for a month, the guy's stuck there. But now he's raised out, all right? The lions don't eat him, all right? He tells us that God sent an angel to close the mouths of the lions, and the king is like, thank goodness, and brings them out and, you know, just basically says, everybody can worship the God of Daniel because that God can close the mouths of lions. An amazing sort of thing, a very hopeful sort of thing. And then we get chapter 7. Chapter 7 is what we're talking about. So last November, when we first started talking about the book of Daniel, I said that the key to understanding it was this, that we must pay attention to the kind of book that it wants to be. Sometimes we have a habit of making things the kind of books we want them to be, right? But Daniel, to get it, we got to let it say what it wants to say. So we've got to pay attention to what kind of book it's trying to be. Daniel looks like straightforward history. It looks that way, but it's doing a whole lot more than just telling us what happened when. All right, it's doing a whole lot more than straightforward history. Daniel wants to tell us a story. He wants to tell us a story, and it's a story about God more than about anyone or anything. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, these big figures, King Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, all these guys, the very people of Israel themselves, they're key players in the story. But they're just there really to tell us something about who God is and what we're supposed to do in light of that. Which means that Daniel's not really trying to give us what we might typically think of as history here. It's not some straightforward account of what happened in the past, and it's certainly not, when we get to chapter 7, as we're about to see, it's not an attempt to tell us in detail what's going to happen in the future either. You see, Daniel chapter 7 through 12, this next section, this next half of the book, has a lot of what we call prophecy in it. But even here, even in these prophetic chapters, Daniel's just trying to do a lot of the same thing as he's done in the first six chapters of the book. Daniel wants to tell us who God is, what God is doing, and how we should live and act in light of those facts. So nowhere is this more important than the chapter that we're looking at today, chapter 7. Chapter 7 is the spine of the book. It holds everything together. You'll probably remember that so far in the six chapters that we've covered, we've had a bunch of these nice little self-contained stories, novellas, we might say. We get the fiery furnace, we get Daniel in the lion's den, we get this writing on the wall, and so on and so on. Today, in Daniel 7, all of that starts to change. Daniel 7's weird. It's really weird. And it's only going to get weirder as we go along. So if you don't like this, I'm sorry. We've got like 5 more weeks. And so send me a note and say, please stop it soon. All right. So open up your Bibles. If you don't have one, they're in your pew, the little black Bible. Open up to Daniel chapter 7. Actually, I don't have a page. Somebody yell it out. 724. This feels like the price is right to me. All right? 724. Okay, 724 in the Pew Bible. Daniel chapter 7. Look at verse 2. Daniel's no longer only interpreting other people's dreams. That's the type of stuff we got often in the first six chapters. Now Daniel's having dreams of his own, all right? Dreams of his own, and they're literally out of this world. Take a look, verse 2. I, Daniel, saw in my vision by night the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I watched, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a human being. And a human mind was given to it. Another beast appeared, a second one, that looked like a bear. It was raised up on one side, had three tusks in its mouth among its teeth, and was told, "Arise, devour many bodies." After this, as I watched, another appeared like a leopard. The beast had four wings of a bird on its back and four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the visions by night a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth and was devouring, breaking in pieces and stamping what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that preceded it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns when another horn appeared, a little one coming up among them. To make room for it, three of the earlier horns were plucked up by the roots. There were eyes, like human eyes in this horn, and a mouth speaking arrogantly. Can you picture it? Do you want to? No! This is crazy, all right? This is crazy stuff. If my daughter woke up in the middle of the night and started telling me this dream, I'd probably make an appointment. A little baby horn with tiny little eyes and a smart mouth starts to grow out of some wild beast's head and pushes out three other little horns just for the fun of it, it seems. Nothing about this vision, this nightmare, seems straightforward. Even Daniel is confused. So he asks an angel a few verses later, and we still seem to be within the dream. He asks this angel what all this means. And this is what we hear. Look at verse 17. "As for these four great beasts," the angel says, "four kings shall arise out of the earth, but the holy ones of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever." And that's it. There's your interpretation. Not much help, right? Fortunately, we get a little bit more about the fourth beast a little bit later on, the one with all that the horns and the eyes and the little horn that plucks up the others. Here's how the angel describes that fourth beast. Verse 23, "As for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth that shall be different from all the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. This one shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, and shall attempt to change the sacred seasons and the law, and they shall be given into his power for a time, 2 times and a half a time. That's as confusing as the regular dream, all right? If you ever seen one of those big charts talking about the end times, I don't know, some of you may have seen these things. I grew up and these things were all over the place. Charts about the end times, things like the rapture and the tribulation, books like the Left Behind series. Does this ring a bell? All right, this is where they get a lot of their information, from the book of Daniel, especially chapter 7, especially this stuff about a time, 2 times and a half a time. By the way, that's often interpreted as 3.5 years. 1 time is a year, 2 times is 2 years, and half a time, simple math, 3.5. All right, so that's half of 7, which is important. All right, at least as we're told, and it's often described as the period of time that we call the tribulation, which is supposed to be 7 years, when all the world is going to be held under the sway of this mighty and evil ruler, hence tribulation. But the point of Daniel 7 isn't really that tribulation. Even of the very idea of tribulation that lasts 3.5 years, even that idea is used to say that this is not how it ends. It's a means to an end. Take a look at what the angel says in verses 26 and 27. "Then the court shall sit in judgment, and the dominion," that is of the fourth beast with all the horns, "his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and totally destroyed. Then the kingdom, or the kingship and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them." So trial, tribulation, end with victory, deliverance. In other words, God wins. The end. That's the point. Daniel's whole vision. God ends. I mean, it ends, God wins. There it is. Tomorrow's Martin Luther King Jr. Day, right? So you better expect that I'm going to give you a little quote from King. So I'm going to throw something in from him that this chapter in Daniel makes pretty easy. One of King's most famous lines, one of his most famous lines could have been pulled straight from this passage in Daniel 7. And that's this, that the arc of the universe bends towards justice. The arc of the universe bends towards justice, King said. Not only has this idea of the arc of the universe bending towards justice got to be one of my favorites of Dr. King's concepts, but it's inextricably linked. It's inextricably linked in MLK's mind to the gospel. It's linked to how Christians will later come to make sense of what's going on right here in Daniel. Just listen to how King talks about it when he mentions it. He says this, evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy a palace. Evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy a palace and Christ a cross, but that same Christ will rise up and split history into AD and BC, so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. Yes, King says, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So evil may shape events that Caesar will occupy a palace and Christ a cross, but the same Christ will rise up, split history, so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by the name of Jesus Christ. There's very little else in Daniel 7 than that. Four terrible kings rise up and wreak havoc on the world, and what they do is terrible, but they're not the end. They're not even close. Just listen to what Daniel sees right after that little arrogant horn with all the eyes pops up. And as I watched, he says, the beast was put to death and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. As I watched in the night visions, I saw one like a human being coming with the clouds of heaven, and he came to the Ancient One and was presented before him. To him was given dominion and glory and kingship, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. Daniel 7 may sound like this strange little fairy tale full of crazy visions and images that make you want to cringe, but its point is actually surprisingly simple. It's that God's got this. Life may be particularly bad right now, but one day, God is going to see to it that everything is made right. God is going to see to it that justice will come and that evil will not win, and that no matter what things may look like today or tomorrow or in 20 years or 2 millennia, God's got this. That's Daniel 7. Over the years, however, people have looked at the four beasts in Daniel's dream, and they started to see them as representing different things. Around the time when Jesus was alive, it was thought that they were the last four, these beasts, were the last four great empires that had come by that time. You had Babylon, Persia, Greece, and then Rome. Fast forward a few thousand years, and the interpretations have gone the way you might expect. During the Cold War, the kings and beasts in Daniel's dream started to look a whole lot like China and the USSR. Sometimes even we decided these weren't kingdoms or nations at all. Instead, Daniel was talking about ideologies, communism, fascism, maybe colonialism. Whatever the case, it seems like when we come to Daniel 7, we can't help but read our own enemies into it. When I was looking, studying for this sermon, I actually ran across a group of people who swore that the little horn with all the eyes and arrogant mouth, it had to be the papacy and a corrupt Roman Catholicism. The genius of Daniel 7, though, is that it refuses to be tied down to any of our interpretations. It refuses to be tied down to what we might think it's talking about. Daniel's not trying to pinpoint the exact king or queen or nation or ideology that is going to rule the world. You see, the book's not the book's not really worried about those kinds of details at all, because it's not trying to lay out a roadmap of what's to come. Instead, Daniel 7 wants to do a simple thing. It wants to give us hope. It wants us to remember that God's got this, and that the arc of the universe does indeed bend towards justice, even when everything around us might seem like that can't be the case. That can't be the case. Daniel was written to a group of people, Jews, who are still under the throes of foreign empires. They still feel like exiles in their own land. And it's written to give them hope that something better is coming. There's a problem here, though. It's been a really long time, and it was for the Jews, and it is for us. It's been a really long time since Daniel was written, and we're still waiting around, hoping for the fulfillment of that promise. We're still waiting around. It's true that as Christians, we believe that Jesus is the one who Daniel says in verse 13 looks a lot like a human being coming with the clouds of heaven. We believe Jesus became human, died for us, and then rose again, and by doing so was able to defeat sin and death and evil. But then we also believe that Jesus ascended into heaven and will one day come again to finish what he started, because we can look around and we can say that, well, that sin and death and evil are still here, so what's going on? Hopefully he's going to finish what he started. But that was 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years. And after 2,000 years, hope seems to wear a little thin. Of course, it's also true that we don't have the same problems that Daniel and his friends had. They're prisoners of war, they're exiles, they're refugees, they're stuck in this foreign land where they're not really able to worship how they want to most of the time. All right, we're in a much better place than the folks in Jesus' day too, all right? We're in a much better place, but we're also 21st century Americans. What about the rest of the world today? What about the rest? Right? Not everyone is as lucky as we are. And just because we're privileged to live in a place like this doesn't mean we don't have our own problems, right? Don't have our own problems and concerns. Daniel doesn't just want us to have hope that no matter what that God's going to deliver us from exile in a foreign land. Daniel wants us to have hope that no matter what we're dealing with, no matter what we're dealing with, whether it's grief over a lost person, a lost loved one, depression, whether it's addiction, maybe it's joblessness, maybe it's just unsettledness, maybe it's just the sheer idea that you've got to wake up in the morning and do it all over again. Daniel wants us to have hope that God's going to deliver us from those things too. And he wants us to have hope for others who aren't as fortunate as even we are. So how do we go about living lives of hope today? How do we continue to live well when that hope doesn't just materialize, when it seems so far off, when it's taking such a long time? Taking such a long time. Interpretations of Daniel, even in Jesus' period, consistently tried to find out, map out when it was going to happen. We have Jesus saying, don't worry about that. God's got it. But we have this need to figure it out, because our hope is sort of built upon the realization of it. But Daniel is trying to tell us that maybe our hope needs to be exercised in a different way. One of my favorite lines from the author J.R.R. Tolkien may be helpful here. The Lord of the Rings was his main book. They came out with a bunch of movies now, like 2 decades ago. It's a long time. But anyways, I think this can help us make sense of what Daniel's trying to say, because we often forget that our favorite authors and our favorite actors and all these people are real people, and they have real lives. They have biographies, we might say. And Tolkien, for his part, served with the Lancashire Fusiliers at the Battle of the Somme during the First World War. When I talk about World War I, when I've taught Western civilization and the history of this stuff, I call World War I the War of Disillusionment. Because it started off as, if you look at it, it started off as something like a backyard brawl. All right? Everyone wanted to show off their muscle. They went to war excited. They thought it was going to be over in a couple of months. But it ended as one of the bloodiest and quite possibly one of the most meaningless wars in history. And everyone in the West who had thought we had become some sort of advanced and peaceful society that had virtually done away with wars like this left World War I realizing they had no idea what they were talking about. That's why I call it the War of Disillusionment. Tolkien was in this. And the only thing that kept him alive during the war was that he got trench fever, and they shipped him back to England. And pretty much before he got there, pretty much the rest of his battalion had been wiped out. Events like that influence how people see the world. Tolkien will say by 1918, all but one of his friends had died. The guy was like 20. All but one of his friends had died. Events like this influence how we see the world. At the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien has his main character, Frodo, confessing to the wizard Gandalf that he wished all this evil in the world and the rising of the Dark Lord didn't have to happen at this time, didn't have to happen during his life. So do I, says Gandalf. So do I. And so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. I think that's the question Daniel leaves us with. What does a hopeful life look like? What are we going to do with the time that is given to us? How do we live a life that is both hopeful and good, even when that hope feels like it's a really long way off? The answer, I think, is actually pretty simple. We do the next right thing. Hope keeps us on track. Day in and day out, we wake up in the morning, we decide to do the next right thing, even or especially if we don't know what tomorrow brings. We do the next right thing because it instills in us the fact that there's still some good in this world, and it's worth fighting for. Remember Daniel 3? Remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when they're thrown in the fiery furnace because they wouldn't bow down to that golden statue of the king? Do you remember what they said? They said, if God was able to deliver them, then he would. But even if he didn't, they still wouldn't bow down and worship that king. Here are three guys that knew that the only way to live lives of faith and hope was to do the next right thing. When Daniel in chapter 6 was forced into making the same kind of decision, he could either worship the king of Babylon or be thrown into a lion's den, what did he do? The same thing. He goes up into his upper room where he always prayed. He opens up the windows to everybody who could see him. He looks at Jerusalem and he prays not to the king, but he prays to his God. He does the next right thing. This past week I took Emma to see Frozen 2, and lo and behold, Anna, the movie's main character, sings a power ballad toward the end. She's just lost her sister. She's lost her best friend. Spoiler. Yeah, spoiler alert. Sorry. There's more to the movie than this. She's lost everything, I'll leave it that way. And what she... Way to ruin my flow. All right, there's Anna. She's stuck in a cave. There's a bunch of rock giants all around her. She doesn't know how to get out. She's lost everybody and everything. And she sings a power ballad, as you would expect from Disney. And do you know what the title of it is? The Next Right Thing. And I thought to myself, as I'm crying, because I literally cried for the next 45 minutes of that movie, because I'm a sap, I said to myself, that's what Daniel's talking about, that we got to do the next right thing. The next right thing. Every single morning, you have a choice. You have a choice. How are you going to live into the hope that you profess to believe? How are you going to live into the hope that's promised in Daniel 7? What are you going to do with the time that has been given to you? What are you going to do even when everything around you seems like that hope is way far off? You don't need a well-oiled template for the future. You don't even need New Year's resolutions. Sometimes we can get stuck in the future and forget about the present. You don't need to know how your life is going to fit into God's plan. I'll say that again. You don't need to know how your life is going to fit into God's plan. Why? Because God's got this. You just need to do the next right thing.